Welcome to the Fraud Fighter Podcast. This episode is the 1 year anniversary of this podcast. And thank you so much for being a listener. Listeners are what makes this podcast worth the effort. I get to hear from quite a few of you regarding questions and career topics that you want to discuss. And so I want to be able to talk to you just for a few minutes about what has happened in a year. As some of you may already know, I retired from IRS criminal investigation in March of 2021. Episode 23 talks about the decision that I made regarding retiring after age 50. I took advantage of the retirement plan and decided to go out and start a new chapter in life. I started Nordlander CPA PLLC, which is a boutique forensic accounting and tax resolution firm. And while I did that, I continued the podcast. And for the last couple of months during the summertime, I took a little hiatus and just published one episode per month just because things were getting a little hectic around here with the summer vacations and the small business. So, but just want to give you an update about the podcast. It has now hit over 1,600 different cities and over 100 countries. It is changing right now from weekly, which when I started it, to going to twice a month going forward. The reason being is there is so much going on right now personally with being a volleyball dad, actually. Going to games, going to practices, and that type of thing. So we're going to change it from weekly to twice a month now. But in the last 3 months, the downloads for this podcast have skyrocketed. When I first started a podcast, I was told that podcasts take approximately 6 months or so to gain traction. And this podcast is no different. About 6 or 7 or 8 months into it, then it actually started growing even more. Now, every week we always grew. Every episode that was published was more than the other. However, it's just unbelievable the growth that's been made in the last couple of months for the last couple of episodes. So what's going on now is I'm still giving training to CPAs and attorneys about forensic accounting and tax. And when I do so, I always mention the podcast for people who want more resources about the forensic accounting and anti-fraud and anti-money laundering industry. I'm going to update the website for Nordlander CPA and the Fraud Fighter podcast. That's going to be done a little bit soon. And I'm also speaking at various groups for the next couple of months, ranging from attorneys to CPAs and enrolled agents. If for some reason you are a listener and you're interested in having me speaking, just contact me at nordlandercpa.com or the Fraud Fighter podcast, and you'll have my contact information. You can get in contact with me. Also, I've been spending more time since I retired in March of my exercise and weight and health. And the good news is for the last 2 months, I've lost 15 pounds, which is counting calories and actually doing more exercise, which is what I needed to do anyways. In addition, I've been on also some other podcasts for the last couple of months as well. And we're going to continue to do the forensic accounting and tax resolution. And like I said, right now I'm what I call a volleyball dad. I have a ninth grader that's on the varsity team. And I am thoroughly enjoying going to the games and practicing and being that type of parent where I drop her off and pick her up and travel around and watch her play. So, that being said, I'm going to share the top downloaded episode for the whole year, which is Jeffrey Robinson. Jeffrey Robinson is a best-selling author. And when you listen to this podcast episode, this was given, I believe, he was number 15, if not mistaken. He was, I think, somewhere in November or December of 2020. But this is the top downloaded episode for the whole year. And he's a very good speaker and a very good writer. I've thoroughly enjoyed getting to know him outside the podcast world and offline. We've talked a few times. Thoroughly enjoyed his friendship. But you hear about the giveaway for his book. Just realize that has expired. So just go ahead and disregard it. So thank you so much for being a listener. And thank you for sticking around for a year. This has actually been pretty great. 1 year. Can't believe it's already happened already. And with that, I give you a repost of Jeffrey Robinson, the best-selling author.
That crime is a business. And the way you bankrupt a business like drug traffickers is by cutting off the cash flow and reinvestment. You follow the money. Money laundering is a process, and fraud can be a part of that process.
You're listening to Jeffrey Robinson, a best-selling author, master storyteller, and a leading expert in international financial crime. Welcome to the Fraud Fighter Podcast.
Because fraud is so simple. And when you prove the lie and you prove the exchange of the money, you've proven fraud.
In this episode, we discuss how he got started writing about money laundering, the definition of money laundering, how trade-based money laundering is achieved, and why the best investigators practice shoe leather. As a big thank you for being a listener, there's a special offer for one of Jeffrey Robinson's book called The Takedown. More details will be available at the end of this episode. He's a best-selling author of 30 books. He's also a journalist, author of a well-known The Laundryman. Jeffrey Robinson, welcome to the Fraud Fighter Podcast.
It's entirely my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much. I know you have written many, many books. Not all 30 of them are fraud-related. You've done some fiction and some nonfiction. But the ones that you're best known for are the anti-money laundering books. How did you get into the anti-money laundering space?
You know, writing for a living is all about storytelling. And when you hear a great story, if you are a professional storyteller, you want to tell it. And somebody who happened to have been the customs attaché at the U.S. Embassy in London started telling me some terrific money laundering stories. And this was in the early 90s when no one had ever heard of money laundering. I mean, the Money Laundering Control Act was about 86 or 87. So this was really obscure stuff 3 or 4 years later. And he told me these stories. One of them was about Pablo Escobar having $40 million in cash, which he was storing in a basement in California. And it was taking him so long because he had so much cash all over the United States. It was taking him so long to get this cash into his washing cycle that it sat in the basement and it rotted. $40 million of street cash, a huge pile of pieces of paper, rotted, turned into slush in the basement. And I thought, this is a great story. And I started looking into it. And the money laundering stories that were happening in the early 90s were just fabulous. It was sensational. It was a bunch of really dedicated guys and women in law enforcement who realized that crime is a business. And the way you bankrupt a business like drug traffickers is by cutting off the cash flow and reinvestment. You follow the money. And I've just been telling in The Laundryman and then later in The Merger and later in The Sink and later in The Takedown. And now in a book that will happen, I hope, late next year, at the end of 2021, called The New Laundryman, which looks back 25 years later on what's going on. I've just been telling great stories that are in that anti-money laundering field. They're sensational stories.
So for the audience's sake, what exactly is money laundering? And is that different than fraud? Or is there a difference?
Well, yeah. Money laundering is a process. And fraud can be a part of that process. But what it is simply taking illegally obtained assets, such as street cash, drug cash, putting it through a series of machinations, which include in and out of legitimate finance houses like banks, moving it across borders. Because when you cross jurisdiction, a police officer's badge stops at the jurisdiction. Going in and out of secret bank accounts, in and out of phony shell companies, and then stashing it someplace where you can literally get to it and bring it out that other end disguised as legitimate income. In other words, it looks clean. You put dirty money into a system, it comes out appearing to be clean. Now, I have to tell you, one of the great myths in the money laundering world, and it drives me nuts every time I hear it, is that Al Capone invented money laundering. And the term comes from the fact that he took all of his money from booze and prostitution and gambling and put it into laundromats in Chicago in 1924 and 1925. And you hear this often, and it gets repeated in books by people who should know better. And I have now gotten so upset with this story that I claim anybody who tells you that Al Capone invented the term money laundering doesn't know anything about money laundering. Here's why. When you have street cash from drugs, from prostitution, from gambling, you've got a lot of pieces of paper. In the case of drugs these days, you've got $20 bills, $5 bills, $10 bills. You first need to consolidate that, because if you're a drug trafficker, you've got friends who are drug traffickers, and they're not necessarily the most honest people. And if you're sitting on $5 million in street cash and they can bang you over the head and steal it from you, they will. So you need to reduce the bulk of all that paper and then move it into the legitimate financial system. The Al Capone story supposes that he took all of the street cash and turned it into nickels and dimes so that he could go to the bank with all these coins and say it came from my laundromats, which is ludicrous, because, you know, to go from a ton of street cash to 10 tons worth of coins, it defeats the whole purpose. What's more, in 1924, 1925, 1926, when Capone was riding high, there were no such things as laundromats. The first place that resembled a laundromat was called a washateria, and it was invented in Texas 2 years after Capone was put into prison. So they didn't exist. What's more, the laundromat that we know today, where you throw a quarter into a washing machine or a dryer, was only invented 2 or 3 years after Capone died in the mid-40s. So there were no such things as laundromats. What's more, there was no such thing as money laundering. Al Capone didn't have to launder money because nobody cared if he took all that cash and put it in the bank. No cash reporting. There was no Bank Secrecy Act. There was no Money Laundering Control Act, which came by 60 years after Capone was fooling around with all this money. So when people say Al Capone invented it, that's nonsense. The term actually comes from Watergate. There was something called the Committee to Reelect the President in the early 70s, which two Nixon cabinet officers, including his attorney general and his secretary of commerce, it was Mitchell and Stans, had created this committee to reelect the president. What they were doing was basically extorting companies to make illegal campaign contributions. They extorted airline companies. They extorted an oil company. And they were getting checks, but obviously a check could be followed. So they were sending the checks to a lawyer in Mexico who was then cashing them and sending an order to an associate of Stans and Mitchell in Florida to buy real estate. He would then take this money, deposit it in his account, in his bank account, cash it out, take the cash. And when somebody said, "What are you doing with the cash?" he said, "Oh, the real estate deal fell through. I have to return it, and the guy wants cash." Well, that cash actually went to finance the Watergate break-in, which led to the demise of Richard Nixon. So the Guardian newspaper in England in 1972-73 described this process and said that they were laundering the money to get it back to finance the Watergate break-in. That's the first time the term money laundering was used, 1973.
So how is money laundering different than fraud? Or is fraud really just money laundering?
No. It's fraud is a process that can be used to launder money, but not necessarily. It's fraudulent for that Mexican lawyer to say that he was buying real estate when he wasn't.
Right.
That he was working for a client. That's fraud. I mean, that's a fraudulent act. But it's the movement of the money to disguise the money. Now, fraud, I lived in Britain for 25 years, and there was a lot of soul searching about fraud The British approached it very differently. In the United States, whether you're a district attorney or a U.S. attorney, you've got specialist prosecutors who deal with fraud. And they go before a jury and they understand that fraud, as I define it, is a very simple crime to understand. It's dead simple. I tell you a lie, you give me money, that's fraud. And no fraud is ever more complicated than that. The series of theatrics that fraudsters go through to try and convince you that they're real, that can be complicated. But, and here's where I get into trouble, consider the fact that a jury of 12 Texans could understand Enron. I claim that any jury, any place can understand fraud when you define it as, you tell me a lie, I give you money, that's fraud. In Britain, they went through all this soul searching, claiming that fraud was too complicated for a jury to understand because they didn't have professional fraud prosecutors the way we do in the United States in district attorney's offices and U.S. attorney's offices, guys who and women who prosecute fraud every day. In Britain, they tried to claim that fraud, only a judge could understand a fraud case, and the prosecutors would overcomplicate it, and therefore you should not have a jury trial in a fraud case. It's nonsense, because fraud is so simple. And when you prove the lie and you prove the exchange of the money, you've proven fraud.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are that expression, if you believe this, I have a bridge in Brooklyn to sell you. That actually comes from a guy who in the 30s and 40s was standing outside a Grand Central Station waiting for tourists to come to New York and telling them that he needed some money and he owned the Brooklyn Bridge and he had the paperwork and would they like to buy the Brooklyn Bridge. That was actually a fraud that was committed by a guy, which is how that whole term comes about. Now, what's the lie? That he owned the Brooklyn Bridge. Where's the exchange of money? Well, here's $100. Now I own the Brooklyn Bridge. No, that's fraud. And it's never more complicated than that. Fraud is used as an excuse in money laundering to disguise the money. But the money laundering aspect is a whole different process, where fraud is merely a part of it.
You were talking about Escobar's cash in your writings or in your investigative journalism. What other money laundering proceeds are there other than just cash? We talked about putting cash into the system. What else is there?
Yeah, let me say that Escobar, Medellin cartel and the Cali cartel, especially the Cali cartel, Escobar was a thug. But the Cali cartel was run by two businessmen, one of the two brothers, the Orihuela brothers. One was a lawyer, and the other owned a chain of pharmacies in Colombia. They were legitimate businessmen who understood business. And again, crime is a business. And they modeled the Cali cartel on General Motors. And if you took the corporate structure of General Motors, you know, chairman, vice chairman, president, CEO, CFO, and logistics, and manufacturing and all of those positions on one of those charts that show the corporate leadership of General Motors, and you had superimposed that on the corporate leadership of the Cali cartel, you would see exactly the same chart. It was exactly the same. The difference between General Motors and the Cali cartel in those days, General Motors was the world's largest legitimate corporation. The Cali cartel's turnover was five times that of General Motors. You're talking enormous amounts of money, and that's street cash. Now, in those days, in the 80s and in the 90s, when I started writing about this stuff, illicit drugs was the major engine that drove money laundering, because it was the major engine that created all this cash. And drugs today, it's a little known fact, but the UN substantiated this, illicit drugs today is worth more money on a global scale. More money is spent on illicit drugs on a global scale than is spent on food. Think about that. How many people are on this planet? How many billions of people? They have to eat every day. And yet, the amount of money that all those billions of people spend on food is less than the amount of money being spent on illicit drugs. It's the largest cash crop. And it creates enormous amounts of cash. But today, 25 years after the laundryment, today, drugs are not the largest component of the dirty money that is being laundered around the world. That dirty money represents somewhere between, difficult to say, somewhere between 2 and 5% of world GDP. colossal amounts of money. But the largest single part of that 2-5% is no longer drugs, it's corporate and political corruption. And that's not a cash business. Those are funds being wired through otherwise legitimate banks, being held held in escrow by otherwise legitimate lawyers, being put on the books by otherwise legitimate accountants, the so-called gatekeepers. And they're the ones that need to be targeted, the gatekeepers in the money laundering world, because they're the ones who not only could stop it, they're the ones who are making a living doing it. It's a very, very serious problem in the world today.
When you talk about corruption, you're talking about, give me some money and I'll get you the contract, give me the money.
That's right.
I can make sure you get the building permit.
Yeah. Funny, I'm doing a television adaptation drama of based on money laundering stories. And I've now written four of the scripts, and I hope not 2021, but maybe we'll go into production 2022. Things take a long time. And I've got two Colombians, and one of them is my main protagonist, who is a trafficker, but he's a businessman, because they're not the Escobar thugs anymore. They are guys in $2,000 suits, backed up by lawyers, accountants, and bankers, who are doing business, and money is flowing through these businesses. And yes, it's drug money, and yes, it's corporate corruption and whatnot. And he gets a phone call from one of his guys who says, we've got a problem. You know, in Colombia, there's something called the San Andresitas. And these are shopping malls named after the island north of Colombia, which is called San Andres, which is like a duty-free island. And a lot of the trade-based money laundering products come through San Andres and get fed into the San Andresitas, these shopping malls where they sell the smuggle into the country, and they sell the televisions and the backhoe loaders and the stereos and whatever, mm-hmm. the computer, bought with drug money in other places, part of a trade-based money laundering scheme. I discovered them on a trip to Colombia back in the 90s, and I was shocked to find out that the San Andresitas are owned largely by politicians.
Shocking.
The crooked politicians in Colombia who know about the money laundering and are being paid off set up these San Andresitas, and they help the trade-based money launderers that way. So I've got these two characters talking, and one of them says to the main guy, he says, we've got a problem. He says, what's the problem? He says, well, we paid off the contractor, but he's got a brother-in-law. So the main guy says, well, I still don't see a problem. He says, well, you know, we're supposed to pay off the brother-in-law? And the main guy says, we live in Colombia. We pay off everybody. And that's why corporate and political corruption is the largest single chunk of dirty money circling the world today.
Based upon your experience, if someone wanted to get into the anti-money laundering, anti-fraud space, and they are, let's say someone, maybe a teenager or a young person, either in college or coming out of college, what would you recommend to them?
Listen, law enforcement is filled with possibilities for people who are interested in the subject. I do have a lot of time for the IRS CID, sensational work in what's called no dope conspiracies, where the drugs are already in the country. You can't find them anymore, but you have traces of money. You follow the money. And the IRS, nobody is better at following money than the IRS. There's that. Customs has now Homeland Security has worked fabulous money laundering cases. There's state and local police. And whereas there's a kind of resistance at some levels in law enforcement to specialize in dirty money, there's more and more opportunity because there's more and more of it. And there are plenty of ways that you can learn about this stuff and work your way into a field where dirty money matters. Now, I know you're in North Carolina, and there's a story I'm telling in the new book, again, late next year, called The New Laundryman, about a county deputy sheriff who was moonlighting in one of the tobacco big box stores, and he saw a bunch of people come in to buy up cigarettes, and they were buying up hundreds and hundreds of boxes of cigarettes. You know, there was a limit as to how many each guy could buy, and they were going up to the limit, packing them in the cars, and driving away. And he saw this night after night after night that he was moonlighting at his second job. And he reported it. And his sheriff didn't want to know. Said, well, you know, we're not impacted. They said, no, but this is a money laundering thing. This sheriff understood that. He said, they're taking these cigarettes. They're going someplace and selling them, be taxed. And what's happening to the money? And the sheriff said, well, it doesn't impact North Carolina. We're not interested. He finally found an ATF guy who was interested. And they turned it into a huge federal case because the guys who were buying the cigarettes were Hezbollah guys. The cigarettes were going to Michigan, being sold in bodegas there, detaxed, and the money was being sent to Hezbollah in the Middle East. So if you open your eyes to this stuff, it's all over the place. But there are people like that former sheriff who just wasn't interested. You have to push down those barriers and say, I'm interested in this, and I'm going to go for it. I'm going to find an agency someplace that does this work and hook my wagon to that star.
That case actually was prosecuted out of Charlotte, I believe.
That's right. It was indeed. It was a great case. And I've spoken to all the players. It's a textbook case of really great police work, of being keeping your eyes open to seeing things that shouldn't be there and saying, why not? Why are they there? Or things that aren't there and say, why aren't they? It's about anomalies. And that's the basis, I think, of all great investigation, the anomalies.
So what are you seeing in the future regarding anti-money laundering?
Well, it's either going to get better or it's going to get worse. It's not going to remain the same. Not going to remain the same. If it gets worse, it's because too many prosecutors say, it's too complicated to do. And what we're going to do is just bust the bank. They'll pay up. And the situation will get worse. The fourth book of the four, Launderman, Merger, Sink, is called The Takedown. And it's a story of a suburban mom out on Long Island who happened to have been an assistant U.S. prosecutor, a U.S. attorney, out of the Brooklyn office, Eastern District of New York, and a former legacy customs guy, a narc at Homeland Security, who was the son of a coal miner in West Virginia. And they're both kind of lunatics. They're wonderful. I love them, but they're both kind of lunatics. At one point, when there was a direct threat to his life, the marshals moved in and said, where is your gun? He said, I never carry it. I said, what do you mean you never carry it? He said, well, I've got an old 44 Magnum. They said, nobody uses a 44 Magnum anymore. Everybody's got semi-automatic 9mm. He said, no, he said, this is good, but I don't carry it. There's a threat to your life. He's not going to. And I mean, he's a complete lunatic, but they both understood money laundering. And what happened was two guys in the El Dorado Task Force, which is in Manhattan, a wonderful group, terrific group of guys and women busting money laundering as part of HIDA. They tracked down some money remitters in Queens where money was coming in, cash was coming in, money was being wired out, and they had no customers. It was all phony.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to bust them. So they took it to one of the assistant U.S. attorneys, prosecutor, and she said, I'm not going to do this because we're going to shut them down. And then what? Two more will open up. It's useless. Forget it. I'm not interested. So they went to this particular legacy customs guy, whose name is Remedio Viola, and they said to him, they don't want to take it. And he said, call Bonnie Clapper. She's out at the Long Island outpost of Eastern District. She loves this stuff. She'll prosecute it. So they called her, and she said, of course I'll prosecute it. And this is now in the mid-1990s. They started this prosecution of these remitters. And they followed the money and they followed the characters and discovered that the money was part of a huge conspiracy orchestrated by somebody called the Norte Valle Cartel, the North Valley Cartel. And neither Justice nor Treasury had ever heard of the North Valley Cartel. They discovered it. At the time, the Norte Valle Cartel was responsible for 60% of all the drugs coming into the United States. And no one in Washington had ever heard of these people. These were a bunch of terrible guys, thieves and cattle thieves and murderers and whatnot in Cartago, Colombia. They weren't Medellin, they weren't Cali, they weren't Bogota, they were in Cartago up in the mountains. And Bonnie Clapper and Remedio Viola spent 15 years tracking down 32 heads of the Norte Valle Cartel. Two ended up dead. The other 30 all ended up being extradited to the United States, doing serious time in serious federal prisons. Now, that's because two people really understood and wanted to make a difference. And I wrote a book because I was so amazed at the resistance they encountered within the government, saying, look, you know, you're going after these people in Cartago, Colombia. You're never going to get them. We have plenty of drug traffickers in the United States. Why don't you bust them here? And they said, no, these are important people. So anybody with a real interest in doing this stuff can find a home if they look, because there's plenty of places where there are people like Lonnie Clapper and Remedio Viola who want to make a difference and will help.
Especially with today, with technology, it is easy, much easier now to go across countries than it was, you know, 25, 30 years ago.
For sure.
Yeah.
But there is still bulk cash. There is still bulk cash smuggling. It's still being done. Now, the new trend, or the newer trend because of technology, is trade-based money laundering and the black market peso money laundering, where the street cash gets used in the country. It doesn't get moved at all to buy backhoe loaders, to buy tractors, to buy television sets for the San Andresitas in Colombia, to buy whatever it is, and then get shipped looking like a legitimate shipment. The first of the black market peso.
For the audience, like, explain trade-based money laundering. We talked about the drugs are sent into the United States. Let's take an example. The cash is sitting here. How do you get it back to, let's say, Mexico, Colombia, pick your country? And what they do is that instead of shipping the cash back, they buy cell phones.
They buy product.
Explain trade-based money laundering.
What happens is it's part of a series called the Black Market Peso. You're a trafficker in Colombia, and you've got $10 million in street cash sitting in Chicago. All you want is your $10 million bucks minus the commission that it's going to take to launder it. I'm a black market peso guy. I say to you, listen, I'm going to give you $6 million in cash for the $10 million. Will you take that? And I'm going to hand it to you in pesos right now.
Mm-hmm.
But then I own the $10 million in America. And the guy says, yeah, 40% is a little expensive, but I'm done with it. Sure. Give me the 6 million in pesos. So I pay him the 6 million in pesos. I now go to an industrialist who's looking to keep some money or has money outside of Colombia because he's been evading taxes and he's been bilking his own company and he's been putting the money outside and he's got money. And I say to him, listen, I'm going to sell you $10 million worth of street cash. It's going to cost you $8 million bucks. He says, well, that's a good deal. So he now gives me $8 million, $6 million of which I paid to the guy who owned the drugs and owned the money. I now make $2 million, and he's got $8 million. He's got $10 million in America. So what we're going to do is we're going to buy stuff with that $10 million, and we're going to buy cell phones, and we're going to set up a legitimate-looking company to buy the cell phones, and we're going to import these cell phones into South America through Panama, where we can fool around and do all sorts of things by changing company names and disguising whatever, using secret bank accounts. So now we've got a company. This guy's got $10 million worth of cell phones, for which he's paid $8 million bucks. And he's got a company that's selling cell phones all over South America. That money comes back to him as legitimate income. But the money he's stolen from his company is now back in his pocket without the tax people giving him a headache for it. And the black market peso exchange and this trade-based money laundering is huge. It's unbelievable. When it first started, it was the Bell Helicopter Company that got approached by a guy who had street cash. And he said, I want to buy a helicopter. They said, well, that's what we have. He said, well, I want a blue one. He said, well, we've got blue ones. He said, I want one with leather seats. And he said, that's not a problem. We can put in leather seats. He said, how about an 8-track stereo? That's how long ago this was. Yeah. Yeah, we can throw an 8-track stereo in there. He says, well, let me look at it. He said, this is a nice one. It kicks the tires. And says, how much is it? And they said, $3 million, whatever it was. He says, okay, I'll buy it. They said, that's fine. And they pull out a bill of sale and they say, is that cash, credit card, money order? How do you want to pay for it? He says, I'll have money sent to you. You'd think that the Bell Helicopter Company would have picked up on it. But in those days, nobody realized he had 25 different sources of payments. Something like that, 22, 25, paying him 30 different ways. So the $3 million was paid in 30 different payments from 25 different sources. Did Bell Helicopter care? No.
No, they get their money.
They got the money. They don't care. There's a little old lady in New Jersey who's written a check for $5,000. Did they say this is bizarre? Why would that happen? No. What do they care? Today, they've been educated, as have all the companies in the United States, that you can't have that many payment sources and that many payments, that there's something wrong here. So they're aware of payments and whatnot, but not in the rest of the world. In the old days of trade-based money laundering, you needed Colombians on both sides of the deal. Today, it doesn't work that way. You have non-Colombians. You've got people setting up companies to cater to the Colombians. You've got people buying tractor equipment in England going through Ghana. I mean, there's no drug money in Ghana. There's no Colombian presence in Ghana. And then being shipped into Colombia. And it looks like a legitimate deal. So they're very clever at the way they're doing this. And it takes great investigators to say, there's something wrong here. People are telling lies. There's an exchange of money. Fraud is being committed. What's missing from this jigsaw puzzle? What's there that shouldn't be there? What's not there that should be there? That's why a great investigator is so valuable.
Tell me about an investigation that you're most proud of or made a difference in your career. You probably got a ton of them, but just give me one good one.
Okay, I'll give you my favorite fraud story of all. Now I have to preface this by saying that as a 7 or 8 or 9 year old kid, I read the Hardy Boys, and it had a great influence on me.
I grew up on the Hardy Boys. Yes,
that's right. We all did. Anybody who's ever done any investigation has grown up on the Hardy Boys. That's where it all stems from, because we all wanted to be the Hardy Boys. Now, as I got into journalism, and I've been doing this for a very long time. I mean, I started selling my journalism in 1960. And although I only look 28 podcast, I'm actually a lot older than that. And so I've been doing this for 60 years. I'm 75 this year. So I've been doing this for 60 years and learning the art of storytelling and investigative journalism. Now, as an investigative journalist, when I do that, unlike law enforcement, I don't have subpoenas. I don't have handcuffs. I don't have the threat of prison that I can put over somebody. I don't have the threat of perjury I can hold over somebody. Dare I say, I don't have rubber hoses. You know, I've got to do my stuff by guile and maybe some charm and whatever, trying to be more intelligent than the guy who's telling me the story, and understanding that when you're interviewing people in the crime world, in financial crime world, everybody lies. That's the first premise of being a good investigator, of saying, the guy's lying to me. Now let me see what's true and what's not true, but immediately suspecting that you're being lied to. So I go into an investigation with the one tool that law enforcement's got, that I've got, that young investigative journalists don't have, and they don't exercise. The young kids today think they can do it all on Google. You can't. And the one thing that great financial investigators whom I've known in law enforcement and I practice is called shoe leather.
Shocking. You mean you got to go out there and actually talk face to face with people and actually see it with
exactly
your own eyes?
Right. Google doesn't work. The internet doesn't work. Emails don't work. You have to get up and off your ass and go to speak to people and look at them in the eye when they lie to you and then say, you're lying to me. Because I happen to know the answer to the question before I asked it, and I know that's not true. So I go into it, like the Hardy Boys, with shoe leather. I go and I talk to people, and I become a Rottweiler. I don't let go once I've got a lead, and I just follow it and follow it and follow it. I look for anomalies. I look for, again, what should be there that isn't, what is there that shouldn't be. A bunch of friends in law enforcement were tracking down a Nigerian 419er. These are the guys who send you the letters saying, you know, I'm with the oil company of Nigeria, and if you let me have your bank account, we want to put $50 million in your bank account because we've just found it and we can't repatriate it legally. So you're going to put it in your bank account, and when it clears, you're going to send us $35 million and you keep $15 million for yourself. And we've all gotten those emails and those letters, and okay. And they're called 419 scammers, named after the Nigerian law that makes it illegal to do this. So these friends of mine in law enforcement were tracking down this guy, Nigerian in Britain, who was perpetrating a work at home fraud. Now, one of the things, and I'm a trained journalist. I mean, I went to school for this. So one of the things that you learn in school is you're not the story. You're there to report it. You're an observer. You're there to tell the story, but you're not the story. So that when you go to Biafra and you see starvation and the United Nations is feeding you at night, you can't say, I can't eat. I'm going to give my food to those people. No, you have to eat because you need to report the story. And it's hard to do. When you're in a war zone and you see somebody shot, you're not the nurse who's got to go save them. You're the reporter who's got to report on the nurse going to save them. So you don't become part of the story. Okay, these guys are tracking this Nigerian 419er in England. And they've tapped into his emails. And they tell me they're doing it. And I said, gee, I want to write this story. This is a great story. So now they start sending me his emails. So I'm now seeing his emails almost in real time as he's perpetrating this fraud. And what he's done is he has sent out an email through a guy in Pennsylvania who transmits these things, and 100,000 on a weekend. He's doing it months and months and months worth. So he's sending out millions of these things saying, my name is John Smith, and I am managing director of the Newcastle, England textile company. And we're just setting up with clients in the United States. And we need somebody to represent us in the United States to collect fees. If you would be willing to be our representative, what we will do is we will have all of our fees from sales in the United States sent by cashier's check to you. You put it in your bank account, wait 3 days for it to clear, and then we'll give you the wire address to send it out, which happens to be in the Philippines. And we'll also pay the wire, so don't worry about that. And you'll take 15%. Now, the average sale is $5,000. So every time we do a sale, you'll probably be making $750. Would you like to be our representative? It works on a percentage game. They're looking at 1/10 of 1/10 of 1%, you know, 1/100 of a percent. So out of 100,000, they're going to get one. But they're sending out 10 million. So they're going to get 100. 100 people are going to fall for this stunt. None of them realizing that if they Googled the company, they'd see it doesn't exist. If they Googled his name, the name he's using, they'd see that he was perpetrating this fraud with other companies, same thing. Or even saying, wait a minute, today, why do they need me to put their money through my bank account? Why don't they just get paid by PayPal or Apple Pay? Or why don't they have their own bank in America? I mean, this is crazy. There are all sorts of payment methods. They don't need me. And even if they did need me, why would I then wire it to the Philippines as opposed to back to them? And if I can wire it to the Philippines, why don't their clients wire it to the Philippines? None of this makes any sense. Anyway, I'm looking at these emails and I see an email come back to this guy from a woman in the South who says, dear Mr. Smith, I got your email and thank you very, very much. While I don't have a background in accounting, I have done bookkeeping in previous jobs. And this particular job would come as a godsend. My husband has just been laid off. He's on disability, approaching retirement. I've had to take a second job to pay the rent and buy food. This would be really terrific if I could have this job. Please tell me what I have to do to satisfy you so that I could have it. Not realizing, of course, that there is no job, that it's fraud, and she's going to get billed. I looked at this and I said to myself, you're not supposed to become the story. You're not supposed to become involved. You can't feed the starving Biafrans when you're covering the story. You can't save the life of the person who's been shot in the war zone. You shouldn't get involved. But my conscience just got the best of me. I couldn't let this woman fall for this. I had her name. I knew where she lived. So I picked up the phone and I called her one night. And her husband answers the phone. And I said, is Mrs. Jones there? She said, no, she's not. She's working at her second job at the library. She works there at night. I said, you're Mr. Jones. Yes, I am. You're feeling better? Yes, I am. Thank you very much. But it's still very tough. And I can't get around much. And now my heart is breaking. I said, does Mrs. Jones have a cell phone? Yes, she does. And he gives me the cell phone. I call her. She's in the car driving to the library. And I say, Mrs. Jones, you don't know me. But I'm involved with some people in law enforcement who are looking at a fraudster in England who is perpetrating what's called work-at-home fraud. And I start explaining to her that this is a fraud. And she panics and hangs up. She says, I don't know what you're talking about. And she hangs up on me. And I figure, oh my God, now what? Well, the only way I could reach her, I had her email address. So I get on one of the services, Google or Yahoo or whatever, and I get a phony email address so that it can never be traced back to me in case she mentions it to the fraudster and it showed up in the emails with my friends in law enforcement who absolutely beat the crap out of me if I got, you know, for having gotten involved. So I get a phony email address and a phony name, and I send her what would have been, had it been typed, an 8-page letter explaining the fraud, explaining every aspect of it, begging her to do a Google to this guy's name, saying, here's what you'll find, begging her to look at the name of the company. It doesn't exist. And, you know, company's house in London, you can do a search, you'll see it doesn't exist. Explaining to her that there's no reason to have her bank account set up like that. And then saying, here's what's going to happen. They will send you a cashier's check, or what looks like a cashier's check, because it's not, it's phony, for $5,000. You will put it into your bank. 3 days later, you'll see on your bank statement that it's been credited. You will then wire out to the Philippines. Why the Philippines? Who knows? You know, certainly not a legitimate thing. And they will debit your account for $4,250. And then a week later, you're going to get a phone call from the bank saying the check bounced. And you're going to say, but no, you credited me. It was a cashier's check. And they say, no, it was stolen or counterfeit. And we gave you a credit, but we only loaned you the money out of courtesy. We didn't actually collect it yet. Now we can't collect it. You owe us $4,250. You've got to pay us back. Now, for this particular woman, $4,250 in her situation might have been 2 months' rent and food. There was no way she could have afforded to take that hit. Impossible. And I prayed that she would pay attention to this 8-page email that I'm sending her, explaining this whole thing, begging her not to get involved, to just drop it. And I'm watching the emails, and a day goes by, nothing. And another day goes by, nothing. And the third day, there's an email from her to the fraudster, and my heart sinks. She said, but then I read it, and she says, Mr. Jones, thank you, or Mr. Smith, thank you very much for your kind offer. I no longer wish to be considered for this job. Sincerely yours, Mrs. Jones. And I figured, wow, yes, thank goodness. I've actually saved her, and I'm very proud of that. I should never have gotten involved, and I kind of violated the trust that these guys in law enforcement put in me, because I'm not supposed to be involved, but I just could not stand by and watch this woman essentially go bankrupt. It was just, it just bothered me so much. Then I reread her letter. And she says, I no longer wish to be considered for the post. And that opened my eyes to something. I explained to her in 8 pages that this was fraud, that it was a lie, that there was no job. But he was so convincing and had touched so many of the right buttons with her, as he did with other potential victims, that somewhere in the back of her mind, even though intellectually she knew there was no job, somewhere in the back of her mind, she figured, well, maybe there is. She wanted to be a believer. And that brings up the thing about fraud that makes it so insidious, that fraud is a two-way street crime. The fraudster can't get into your bank account unless you open the door to your bank account. And when you look at fraud, in her case, as a senior, you know, an older person, you look at elder fraud, when they're defrauding grandmothers and grandfathers, people who can't afford to lose the money, and they get hit. They're so embarrassed for having cooperated with fraudster that they don't tell anybody. They don't report it to the police. They don't tell their children. They don't tell their lawyer. They don't tell their friends. They just take the hit and suffer in silence.
It's very similar to a romance scheme where,
yes,
you sit there and you have to tell this poor guy or poor girl who is lonely that what they're doing, frankly, is a crime or facilitating a crime because they have emotionally wrapped themselves around somebody who does not exist.
That's right.
And they're being manipulated. That's right. And for some reason, they still can't get it through their head that this pretty picture of this gorgeous guy or gorgeous girl, that's not real. That is somebody else. You don't have a clue who they are, and they're using you, but they're still holding out hope, still talking to these folks. I'm like, this is sad that I have to give them had to give them the wake-up call of, I'm sorry that your heart's broken, but you need to stop because you're facilitating a crime.
It's exactly the same thing, and you're being duped. Listen, I know, because I mean, my wife is trying to tell me those emails are not really from Michelle Pfeiffer. I assure her they are. But she's saying, no, 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 it's not really Michelle Pfeiffer. In the case of that woman with the work at home fraud, their lies were so good that she kind of wanted to believe there was a job.
Are there any resources or training that have helped you in your being an investigative journalist or an author?
Yeah, I mean, the Hardy Boys certainly opened my eyes to this jigsaw puzzle that's called investigations, but it's really not based on that. The driving force is storytelling, and it's being able to tell a great story. And fraud stories, I mean, look at the stuff you watch on television, or police procedural. Why is Law & Order SVU so engrossing? Because they're great stories. Sure, the acting and everybody loves Mariska. And no, it's great storytelling. That's what the basis of all this is. I lived in France for many years, and I befriended a husband and wife who were just sensational to me. They were like my godparents. And his name was Lino Ventura. You have to be a real film buff to know that name, but he was the Humphrey Bogart of French movies. I mean, he was the major male star. And Lino always played the hard cop with the marshmallow heart, you know, that character that we often see. And he said to me once, he said, look, there are three elements that make for a great movie, a great film. The first is a great story. The second is a great story. And the third is a great story. Same thing with the book. Same thing with the television show. It's all based on great stories and storytelling. And that's what really motivates me, is being able to tell a great story. The Takedown, the story of Bonnie Clapper and Remedio Viola, is probably the single greatest story I've ever had the privilege of telling. I'm not bragging and saying I told it brilliantly. I think I did, but that's another story. It, as a single story, when I heard that story, I said, this is the best story I've ever had.
It's interesting you say that, because honestly, when it comes to prosecutions, it's a great story. It's just something that you tell a jury what the story is, and they either believe it or don't believe it, and you have to bring up witnesses or eyewitnesses to sit there and say, hey, this is what happened to me. This is what happened. A jury ultimately has to believe that story or not believe the story, but it's really what it is. It's great storytelling.
Great litigators are great storytellers. Yes, absolutely.
What do you wish you had known before you started this career?
The one thing I wish I had known was the importance of time. Time is a diminishing commodity. And I spent a lot of years as a world-class procrastinator. I misspent my youth wasting a lot of time. And you can imagine what I was wasting my time doing. After I finished my military service in the 60s, I was an officer in the Air Force. And I finished there and I decided that I was going to go someplace and learn how to write for a living, learn how professional storytelling and professional writing, even though I'd been writing at this point for 7 or 8 years. And I went to the south of France, you know, the French Riviera. The weather was good. I was going to go someplace to write. And I didn't speak French. I had no money. And I lived there for 12 years and constructed a career as a journalist. My newspaper was the Herald Tribune in Paris, the International Herald Tribune, and I wrote hundreds of features for them. And then wrote short stories for the women's magazines and wrote for other magazines, nonfiction and whatnot. And then eventually moved to London because I had to stop being Peter Pan. Took a French woman with me and moved to London to write books and do television. During those early years in France, there was a lot of time wasted. I mean, it was a great place to waste time. And I now realize at my age, time is running out. And I wish I had known then that it was going to run out, that there were other things I should have been doing. And I could have gone a lot further, a lot faster. And I work 7 days a week. I go to the office every day. And not because it's my job or I can earn money doing it. It's because that's who I am.
Do you consider yourself a writer or an author?
I consider myself a storyteller. Yeah, let me explain the difference. When you build a house, you need an electrician, a carpenter, you need a plumber, you need a mason, you need whatever. Those are writers or journalists. But before you build the house, you got to have an architect. Somebody's got to design it. That's a storyteller. I can do all the skills. I can do the carpentry. I can do the plumbing. I can do the masonry. But I have to be able to tell the story, and I have to know what that story is. And I have to identify a story. And, you know, it's funny because you develop a skill of identifying a story.
Looking back in your career, what is your biggest mistake or lost opportunity? You talk about your wasted time in the south of France. Is there something else?
I don't talk about my wasted time in the south of France because it would embarrass my wife and horrify my kids. So I do not talk about that. Yeah, I think that the one regret, if there's anything, or the one mistake, was not understanding that time is finite. You know, opportunity knocks, and we sometimes say, it's Saturday. I don't think I'll go. No, when the opportunity comes available to do something, you should take it because you never know where it's going to lead.
You ready for the final four questions?
Sure.
What is your biggest motivation now?
Being able to tell all the stories I want to tell with the clock still running, because eventually the clock stops and then it's really hard to tell those stories. So I want to do it now.
What particular stories are interest you?
Some of them are in this line of fraud and money laundering and financial crime because they're just such great stories. It's stories like that. I want really complex, terrific stories. And I love, absolutely love doing it. It's like doing a jigsaw puzzle where you don't have the edges, because everybody who does jigsaw puzzles know you start with the edges. That's the easy way. And you only have one color. You just have pieces that are all the same color.
What books or books have changed your life or thinking? You read this book and said, I wish I'd have read that one a long time ago.
Well, I'm a very bad reader. I really am, because I write for a living, so I read poorly. Because I sit there, it's like sitting on an airplane next to a pilot who's deadheading someplace. He says, what kind of an angle is that for the takeoff? What was that noise?
It's like a TV producer watching TV. You just can't get into
That's exactly right. Yeah.
It's like a cop watching a cop drama going, that ain't right.
That's right. Oh, yeah. Which, by the way, is why the cop dramas, the really great ones, like Law & Order SVU, have former cops on staff to say, no, we don't do that. We wouldn't have done that. We would have done this. When you've got a cop who watches your cop drama, you know that it's right, because they won't watch one that's not right. And I read very badly because I look at something and I say to myself, what the hell is that part? What is he doing? Why is he over there? How did he get there? Silly. It doesn't make any sense. And I abandon it. On the other hand, I will read things that I'll say, this is very interesting. Wow, I love that. And he's telling the story in a circular way and going deeper and deeper inside and keep coming back to that's a neat technique. I like that. And how did he do that? And I want to know. So I read very badly. So it's not a question of one book. It's parts of many books that have influenced me.
Share something that you've purchased in the last 12 months, less than $100, that if it's good enough for Jeffrey, it's good enough for the world. Something that made your life easier, something you enjoyed.
I'm fortunate in that I don't have to do anything for money anymore. I do it because I like doing it. And my main ambition in life these days is to make my wife a wealthy widow. So when I buy something, the satisfaction usually comes from buying it for her or buying it for the kids. I've always loved fountain pens, and I read something somewhere about somebody who was talking about pencils. Now, you know, we all grow up with pencils and a Ticonderoga number 2 pencil. Well, I found out about something called Blackwing 602s, and these are very expensive pencils, but they're very soft and they write very smoothly. And it pleased me enormously to go out and buy some of these very expensive pencils. Not that I use them, but I could send them to my kids and I could send them to my brother and I could send them to people and say, isn't this cool? And yes, I occasionally do use a pencil, especially for editing. So every draft I do, I print out and I take a vintage fountain pen, because there's something ethereally pleasing about working with a vintage fountain pen. And I edit the piece of paper, whether it's 12 pages or 200 pages, with the fountain pen. And when they told me about these Blackwing 602s, I started doing it with that. And it's very pleasing to do it with this extremely smooth pencil, because it's just part of your hand motion. And it's a kind of pleasure in doing it. It's almost the same as using a vintage fountain pen in making the corrections and changing and editing and whatnot.
Final question. If you had to do something else, if you were fired today and could no longer be an author or a writer or a storyteller, what would you be doing?
If people stopped paying me to write, I would still write. You know, if somebody tomorrow said no more, I would still write and just put it away and let my kids worry about it. Because telling stories is just what I do. It's who I am. And if I couldn't tell stories, I'd probably eat and get much too fat. Malamars would do me in. Malamars and dark caramels. I'd be finished.
It's a huge pleasure listening to you on the podcast. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. I do appreciate it. And good luck on your upcoming book. What's your upcoming book called?
Title is always the last thing. I have no idea.
But it should be coming out in 2021?
The New Laundryman, I hope, will be the end of 2021. And then there are other things in the works, including the television stuff. So I keep busy, and it's probably just as well that it keeps me off the streets, because my wife worries about me whenever I go out that I'll get into trouble. So I stay home in my pajamas.
All right. Well, I appreciate it, Jeffrey. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. Good luck to you.
My pleasure.